Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
I don't know. Marcia looked at her husband, Sam. I'm not so sure Maplewood is the best place for raising kids.
What's troubling you, honey?
Sam responded.
Well, I can't put my finger on it exactly, Marcia replied, but it just doesn't feel welcoming.
Mrs. Thompson, their realtor interrupted, would you like to see the community pool? There's a nice clubhouse there with bingo games on Tuesday nights, and the church on Barclay Street has a potluck dinner the last Sunday of each month.
Yes, but, Marcia wrinkled up her nose, I don't see any sidewalks, and,
she made a quick mental inventory,
I don't remember seeing any kids on bicycles anywhere, and today it's a pretty day outside.
Well, the realtor retorted, I'm sure that playground at the school will be just full of kids. I'll take you over there.
That would be interesting, announced Sam, especially since today is Sunday.
From a parent's perspective, what makes a child-friendly community, and how can we improve ours? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guests both have experience living in traditionally planned communities with children, as well as working on these issues professionally. Jennifer Russell was the Planning and Code Administration Director for the City of Gaithersburg, Maryland for 26 years and has served more than 30 years in the public sector. During her tenure, the City of Gaithersburg, Maryland was a laboratory for new urbanism as the location for the well-known neo-traditional communities of Kentlands and Lakelands. New urbanism encourages quality design that promotes mixed uses seamlessly integrated, a grid network of streets designed to feel good for pedestrians, formal and elegant civic spaces and squares, and interesting buildings with front doors set close to the street to promote walking. The lifestyle in these towns is less reliant on the automobile. Jennifer has two grown children. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Diane Dorney is a publisher and owns her own newspaper publishing company called The Town Paper, which is located in Gaithersburg, Maryland. She publishes local community papers and papers about the new urbanism to educate the public about traditional neighborhood planning and development. Diane has three children, two in college and one who has graduated and is working in San Francisco. We're so glad you could join us, Diane.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What makes a community child-friendly?
I think there are a variety of features that you would see in a community that has the kind of energy that you would want children to enjoy. The most obvious was mentioned in your little anecdote, walkability, the presence of sidewalks, the ability for children to enjoy the environment safely. Those are just a few very introductory items that I would put on my shopping list for a community that's child-friendly.
I would also add that in a traditionally planned communities where the streets are narrow and there are sidewalks, oftentimes it's even the streets themselves that become great places for kids. We lived on a little street in Kentlands that was everybody, all of the kids played in the street. They actually brought lacrosse nets and soccer goals into the street, and it was so slow. I mean, there were so few cars that would come down, and if they did, they'd just stop and they'd actually take everything off the street. But yards become less of a place that children play in, and the public spaces, the common grounds and streets and parks in a traditional neighborhood become the places where they all gather, because everybody's separate yard is just a place they can go by themselves, but they know they'll meet other kids if they go to the common areas in the neighborhood.
One of the early concerns when developing and designing Kentlands was the presence of private alleys that are at the rear of the houses and provide the access to primarily rear-loaded detached garages, which is another characteristic of a traditional neighborhood. I recall that during the early days of the planning process, when we were quite naive, and this was in the late 80s, there was a great deal of concern expressed by many of the decision makers who viewed alleys as a negative. They had, I gather, memories of childhood spent where alleys were littered and were unattractive places where maybe rodents inhabited. And there were a variety of legal concerns about maintenance of alleys and the, sort of the hierarchy of alleys in the road system, but there was just a lot of concern about viewing alleys as a negative. When, in essence, if you walk down an alley today, you get a beautiful view of the rear of the gardens. And I used to observe when I took tours children playing in the alleys. They became a resource rather than a negative.
That's interesting, except alleys, I guess depending on how they are, could be a place for crime because they're not as accessible.
Well, in any case, in a traditional neighborhood, the benefits of the streets and the alleys and the passageways, the paths, is that there is a lot of people that can view those places because they're more densely packed with housing. So one of the things we've noticed in Kentlands is that kids get away with very little there, especially children in the elementary, middle, and high schools, because there's so many people watching them. So it's kind of the eyes on the street safety bit. And the alleys, just as much as the front streets, there's just as many windows and people who are looking out in the alleys as they do on the front streets and the public parks and playgrounds.
And also the enviable front porch. Many traditional communities' houses are characterized by a front porch. And the front porches at Kentlands aren't empty. People are on the front porches and they see their children walking to schools and to services that are close by. And they're generally speaking not fearful about their children walking places because they're adequate sidewalks and the distances aren't great, hopefully.
How can parents, when seeing a neighborhood for the first time, assess whether it's going to be a good place for children to live?
I think the component of the sidewalks is important, but not just sidewalks. You have to have streets that are narrow. Just putting a sidewalk on any street, a four-laner, doesn't make it a child-friendly place to be. There are specifications for residential and mixed-use communities that are so many feet of pavement, and then you know that's a good space for people to walk on. Tree-lined streets are another thing that keeps it shady in the summer and protection during the other months when there's elements like rain or snow. And I think that in addition, you know, when you walk around a community, you go into a new community for the first time, you want to see that the places are used. Oftentimes in conventional areas where there's neighborhoods or communities, they allow for lots of parks. There's park space. But when you go by, there are big, huge green spaces that nobody uses. Oftentimes, the parks need to be small and intimate enough so that when people are in them, they feel comfortable. So it's not just about having a park. It's about the type and how it's designed to make it community-friendly.
Yeah, just to elaborate on that, a sidewalk really needs to be wide enough for people to walk together. And the green strip that has the tree that Diane is talking about has to be wide enough to act as a buffer because people want to walk on sidewalks and they want to see activity, first of all. They want to see buildings up at the street, which is sort of a classic approach. But they also want to be buffered from the road, and an adequate green space between the road and the sidewalk that's wide enough to accommodate a tree that won't die in a year or two because its root system is encumbered is important. And also, in a typical suburban development, you'll see these tot lots, very programmed, structured playgrounds that indeed are used, but they're kind of artificial. And I've always liked designs that try to discern where the gathering places are going to be first, and then you design the remainder of the community around that. To me, if I look at a traditional neighborhood design for a community and then look at a suburban community, you'll see that the tot lots are really the leftovers. They're whatever the developer couldn't squeeze into a lot. And they don't necessarily end up being the best gathering place. Whereas in a traditional neighborhood, you'll try to determine where the best public gathering places are, the civic places, and the design will unfold from there. And I think you end up with a more successful design. The other thing is that the best use of park space, if you will, that I've seen is at Kentlands, where we just left an open green space. It's just a wide open green. And you see people walking their dogs, of course. You see people having a Frisbee contest, or there could be an art festival there. And it becomes what the community wants it to become.
And the reason that's successful, that green, is because it's completely bordered by housing and civic buildings. It's enclosed. It's not just an open space that doesn't have anything around it to make it feel like a room.
Yes.
In traditionally designed neighborhoods, all of the park spaces that are designed to feel like their own outdoor room.
And they're integrated into the neighborhood seamlessly. They're not artificial.
So that's something else that parents should look for is a central place of meeting.
Places. More than one place.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on child-friendly communities.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Diane Dorney and Jennifer Russell about child-friendly communities.
I would bet that most people looking for houses and looking in communities don't have access to the kind of community with so many things that you've just described. So what places would they want to visit to help assess how family-oriented a potential community they're considering might be?
Well, one of the things we haven't even mentioned, and is my children's favorite place in our neighborhood, is the town center, where the main street is, the businesses, the shops. And you can tell by walking into these shops how child-friendly they are. Do they sell ice cream, lemonade? Can you get a hamburger for a couple bucks if you give your child a few dollars to go up and get lunch? In our neighborhood, my child was like 8 years old when he would go around with a dollar. He loved that independence of walking uptown and buying his own ice cream cone with his friends, and I didn't need to be with him. And that's a really good test, I think, as long as you walk into the town center and you find those places. In fact, then as the children get older, my children all worked in the town center. So if you walk in and you see children of the ages of 16, 17, 18, and they're behind the counter serving, another good indication that it's a great town for children.
It's interesting. One of my friends is a realtor, and I remember a long time ago when she first went into this business, she said to me, my goal is to try to find homes for families that are within walking distance of town facilities mm-hmm. that their children can go and take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. The newer traditional movement is really just trying to recreate the elements that people found absolutely charming in 19th century towns.
Mm-hmm.
And the original main streets are classic examples, and many of them are now being refurbished. But in terms of areas that had walkability early on, that's what the new urbanist towns are trying to emulate. In the early days of Kentlands, when the town center was already there, and you saw the success of it because you saw children walking, as Diane described, I used to get comments from people that children from other communities were being kind of bussed in. I think it makes traditional towns much more attractive now when everyone's stressed out and gas prices are high and time is, short. For parents to be alleviated from the additional stress of having to take their children everywhere by car.
What subtle red flags would make you shy away from raising children in any specific setting?
I would say now, with the knowledge I have, because I had my children when they were young in a conventional sort of subdivision and then moved into a traditional neighborhood. And now knowing what I do, and when other people ask, driving into a community that I saw that didn't have the qualities of a traditional neighborhood and had isolated, 1 acre lots, I mean, that's great for some people at some time of their life, but I know my children, having to think about it now, would say, oh, that would be just so boring, to live in a neighborhood that was big, big yards. And that was also, for many, many years, seen as like the best thing you could possibly have in your, for a family, for a young family. I think it goes counterproductive to raising children where they can't be around different types of people. They're often economically one type of person that lives on those kinds of streets. In Kentlands, they could see their teacher who lived there, and they could also see someone who was the owner of a very large company, a successful company, all living within the same street, not even in the same neighborhood, but the same street. And I think that's a really, really important thing for children to grow up with.
The sameness element, I would underscore that. There are streets which are designed with a townhouse next to a large home just up the street from condos. And at the time that it was designed, it was considered very innovative, and people were skeptical as to its potential success. But now the most interesting streets in traditional communities have that non-segregation, the integration of different types of unit. The best kind of street has maybe a stick of townhouses next to some cottages, and then single-family detached houses on the same street. It gives you terrific massing and scale on the street. It makes for an interesting street, great place to walk down, slows down the driving because people are watching the different architectural planes. The bottom line is that it invites different types of people to live together without making a huge kind of diversity statement
about it, yeah.
all of us have children who have either gone to or are in college right now, and I know that you probably have similar memories to Sandy's and mine. When we take children to visit colleges, they usually have a visceral sense of whether they'll feel comfortable in a specific setting, and sometimes you'll get there and 10 minutes after you've arrived, they'll say, let's go to the next place. Mm-hmm. This isn't for me. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens when you're house hunting? Should you involve your children in helping to choose a new community or neighborhood?
A lot of course, depends on the dynamics in your family, but I would highly recommend it. As a parent, my observation is that children are a lot more flexible and resilient to change than we expect, probably more resilient than we are. And they probably will pick up on some of these positive characteristics that we've mentioned that are present in a traditional community. If you go somewhere with your children and they don't see any activity, they're likely to be frightened off by the element of uncertainty. But if they see sidewalks where they can ride their bikes, if they see gathering places where there are children, if they see places like libraries, stores, plazas where people are gathered, it's likely to make them feel hopeful about a new future and a new beginning in a new community. We purchased a beach home in a traditional community, much to my husband's chagrin, because he really wasn't a new urbanist at the time. Not that mm-hmm. he is now, but he was very worried about a house very close to our home. But when we went through that process, we took our children along. Now, they were middle-aged teenagers at the time.
Very mature.
Yes. We took them on the whole evaluation of the community, which they were familiar with, and the actual purchasing and negotiating for the home. And it didn't happen quite as quickly as we thought, but they really bought into the whole concept. And I would say now that because of their involvement, they are very committed to the home, and it has become a magnet for our family. Because as your children get older, as we all know, they don't always really want to be with their parents, particularly on a vacation. But when we say that we're going, they're coming. They were also involved in the decision-making, and I think it empowered them, and they feel like it's our family's home.
I think a mistake that a lot of people make is they only focus on the house.
Mm-hmm.
And they take, and it's all about, what do you think of this room? You know, and I think one thing you have to be careful is children often, first of all, don't want change. And they may say, I just want to stay right where I am. They don't realize every time we moved, which was three times since I had children, all of them, no, I don't want to go. I knew where we were going was a better place for them, but it depends on their age. But the other thing is that people just tend to just think about what's around the space that they're actually purchasing instead of opening up their eyes to see what goes beyond even their own block. What's behind me? What is within walking distance? What's the town center made of and can I get there? When I leave this community, how far do I have to drive to get everywhere I need to go every day? I mean, it's a daily thing you're signing on to. And that's one thing I think people are more aware of now, but in the past weren't thinking that way. But now with traffic congestion and the kind of activities children do nowadays as opposed to before, people are thinking about it maybe a little more.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on child-friendly communities.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Jennifer Russell and Diane Dorney about child-friendly communities.
What should we do if we're not relocating, but we do want to make our communities more child-friendly? What things can we do as parents?
Well, I think you can get involved in the political process because change is always in the air. And even if you are in an existing community, many of the characteristics that we've described of traditional neighborhoods, that existing communities can be retrofitted. There are many suburban communities where roads are very wide, and those communities now typically experience a lot of residential speeding. And the people speeding are the people who live there, but they're also the people who complain. Many wide streets have been retrofitted. by simple changes like raised crosswalks, allowing on-street parking, which immediately slows down a street, instead of having a wide 1970s suburban street. You can get involved. You can try to make political decision makers know that some of these, that change and some of these design decisions, some of which are simple, some of which are harder to implement because they require new regulations and ordinance change, are really important for health, for safety. And if people are more involved in design of communities and the political process, actually the decision makers prefer to involve the community and empower them, because as the process goes on, then they have less issues and negative dealings with the community. If the community is involved in the process and feels empowered, then it's an easier road even for political leaders.
How do parents get involved? Where should they turn immediately, like if they have an issue or something they want to do?
I'm not as optimistic about making suburban communities child-friendly. I think all the things we've talked about today, which make them child-friendly and exciting for children to be in and make it easy for them to find their friends and easy to get to the places that are exciting and fun without their parents, you just can't do in a suburban community. I mean, they're very rigid. Suburban neighborhoods that are zoned to be residential only, one price point only, even the street widths are regulated by codes, and those are very, very, very difficult to change. So you probably have to move.
We'll be having realtors on our website any day now.
True. But on the other hand, a traditional suburban community has a quarter of an acre lot. I mean, I think Diane was even talking about half acre, and it's just a traditional single-family house on a lot that has a front lawn, an attached garage, maybe no sidewalk, wide streets, and kids bicycle in their court or a cul-de-sac, which doesn't really promote connectivity. I mean, you do have some suburban communities have cul-de-sacs that have these sort of bike paths that connect, but it doesn't really promote walkability because most parents would be afraid if their children walked far away because they can't really see them. We started to take some of the lessons learned at Gaithersburg and apply them where we could and where it was appropriate to try to ameliorate some of the conditions in conventional suburbs and subdivisions, rather. One way of doing that was to use a sort of artificial means to downscale the pavement. We didn't go in and change the roads. We actually had neighborhood charrettes.
What is a charrette?
It's a dynamic planning process that happens in a blitz, and you incorporate stakeholders who are involved in the community to do a design that under traditional format would take months and months of hearings and discussions. It's all done within 5 to 7 days with a lot of energy. You create a plan, and then there's this tremendous momentum, and you've empowered all the people who were previously objecting to change to be involved. But we used to have neighborhood charrettes in conventional subdivisions with people who were dissatisfied with what the 70s had wrought, and we tried to make changes, not really to make them traditional neighborhoods, but try to improve and take some of the lessons learned and use them to improve as best conventional subdivisions.
How did that work?
They were improved.
Okay.
But as Diane said, you don't get the sense of place and the sense of community that a traditional neighborhood gifts you.
Okay. Let's hear it for small towns all across the
yes,
U.S.
Really, yes.
Unfortunately, we are running out of time. This has been a wonderful discussion. And now, if there are any resources that you can think of to leave parents with who would like to pursue this topic a little further, that would be very welcome.
I would suggest the Congress for the New Urbanism website, which is cnu.org. And in fact, I probably would suggest Google New Urbanism, Smart Growth, Communities. On my website, actually, there is a list of neighborhoods under construction throughout the country that you can click and look under each state. They go through a small process of making sure that they have most of the principles of new urbanism in the neighborhood. So it's kind of a way to, if you're going to move to Ohio, you can click on Ohio and you see the traditional neighborhood developments that are under construction there.
It's
and
like
that
the
website
Parents Magazine seal of approval.
Right. It's kind of like that. And that website is the Town Paper website. It's TND for Traditional Neighborhood Development, tndtownpaper.com. If you want that list.
If you go on the Congress for New Urbanism's website, you'll see that there are 10 principles
11.
That are the basis for the whole movement of new urbanism. And if you read those, it'll give you kind of the flavor of what you might be looking for in a very general fashion. The good thing about it is that there are a variety of opportunities and options in terms of traditional new communities. They're springing up all over the country, so there must be something right going on.
Obviously, there was something right going on here because both of you, Jennifer Russell and Diane Dorney, you have been wonderful to work with today, and you've given our listeners and us a lot of good information about the new urbanism and family-friendly communities. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's very helpful to us. Mention show number 316 and tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a podcast of a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chep. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.